This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, dinosaurs and mega cryptids, man-made monsters in speculative fiction.
So today's episode was suggested by Jules. So in that regard, Jules, I'm just going to throw this at you. So off you go.
We have done quite a few heavy thematic episodes recently, and I thought, let's do something a little bit lighter. So this is kind of a homage to the monster movie. So we will be talking about books a little bit, but it's going to be more about monster movie, which, let's face it, generally aren't very taxing on the brain.
No, they're easy to watch. They're easy to engulf.
But they do have some sort of important archetypal themes and things in as well. But they're really obvious. They're so obvious that you almost miss them. So let's start with the old classic, King Kong.
Yes.
I'm probably a bit sad. My preferences for King Kong are the old 1933 black and white film and the 1976 remake, where, let's face it, King Kong, the giant monkey, really, really does look like he's made of plasticine, because he is made of plasticine. And it's stop motion animation that's really quite clunky when you look at it now. But I love it anyway. The actual story is very basic. The story is kind of a twisted Beauty and the Beast type story.
Yeah.
But I always felt there was quite a bit of pathos about the, I wouldn't say character, because it doesn't really have any character, but the creature, King Kong himself. He's this massive, giant monster gorilla that lives on this island that a bunch of scientists happen to turn up at. And they discover this monster monkey god there, and the best thing one of them can come up with to do is to trank it and stick it in a huge cave and take it on a ship back to New York to show it in a fair.
Mm.
So that's already like really, really bad. I mean, perhaps it wasn't quite as bad in 1933 when, we all thought we were entitled to whatever we wanted, kind of thing.
Yeah. But I mean, one thing with these kinds of monster movies is that they kind of all follow in the same grain as Frankenstein, which is that, that message of just because we can doesn't mean we should.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking, in fact, that ties in with some that we'll get to a little bit later as well, but certainly with King Kong, it's... did you see the most recent one, King Kong Skull Island?
No,
or
I didn't.
Kong Skull Island. I have to say, I watched it with Alan and I was really, really tired that Friday night, and I've got a feeling I fell asleep for a good chunk of it. I don't think I missed that much plot, but it was a lot of like giant gorilla stomping around, and there was more plot than there would have been in the original film,
yeah.
Which wouldn't have been hard. But generally, before that, it's always been there's one woman on this expedition, and the woman kind of has this weird connection with the creature. In the sense of perhaps she's the only one who feels any empathy or pity for it at all. And the giant gorilla sort of responds to this by sort of almost falling in love with her.
Yeah.
I mean, in the classic film, it climbs the Empire State Building carrying her and then falls to its death when it gets shot down by biplanes, which I know is like really unlikely. work with me here. This is clearly a sci-fi fantasy film with a plasticine monkey. But yeah, it is kind of like, Beauty has power over the Beast type thing, which feeds back to all the fairy tales and things we've seen before. But what is it about monster films that really keeps drawing us in over and over again? Because there's King Kong, there's Godzilla. Godzilla's had God knows how many remakes.
Yeah, I mean, there's the whole kaiju thing in general.
Yeah.
With all these monsters. And then, of course, we'll mention Jurassic Park as well and stuff like that.
Yeah.
My theory is that actually we have historically always been obsessed with things which are stronger and scarier than us. And I think it's probably to do with our survival instinct. But because we have a conscious mind that goes above and beyond our instinct to basically say we must prepare for something bigger and scarier than us, and by doing and to do that we must gather as much information as we can about it and to imagine the worst thing so that we can come out with a scenario where we'll survive. I mean, that's, you know, on an evolutionary scale, that's kind of how we've survived, because we're problem solvers naturally.
Yeah.
Problem solving is tied a lot in with how we create stuff, because our imaginations are basically our problem solving brain, where we say, what would I do if a rocket came shooting down this alleyway? Or what would I do if I turned into a ghost, or, you know, things like that. And our brain basically responds and says, well, this is a problem and this is the solution. And that's how we kind of create stories. They start with questions and problems. And so we've always had these questions, and we found dinosaur bones, you know, a long time ago we found dinosaur bones, and we would have found whale bones out in the middle of the desert and stuff like that, you know, things which wouldn't have made sense to us at the time because we didn't understand the geographical changes that had happened and things which had changed. And we've always had stories of giants, and then there were dragons and all sorts of creatures. And I think it literally came from the fact we found these bones and we went, what is this? And then we sort of became obsessed with this idea of something which is bigger and scarier and stronger than us. And not only that, having come up with this idea, because it wasn't actually a direct threat, we got a thrill out of being scared, and that's never changed. We always come back to it.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this particular theory before, but obviously there was a point when we were prey animals quite a long time ago, but in terms of evolutionary history, it's actually not that long ago at all.
Yeah.
And recently they've made discoveries that there is a good deal of evidence that certain memories are actually passed down through DNA. So if you survive something, or your ancestors survive something, then you carry a trace of that memory, that instinct in your DNA. It's really interesting. We are particularly wired for storytelling as creatures, humans are.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it makes sense, if we go back to when we were living in the caves, for us to pass on wisdom and things through story. You remember story,
mm-hmm.
and you remember it in a way, even if you haven't had the experience yourself, because you put yourself into the story, and it's something we've always done. So say one hunter manages to survive an attack by Smilodon, mm-hmm. or the saber-toothed tiger, which didn't technically exist, but I'm trying to be picking. A big cat with big teeth. And they tell the story, and they tell it in a way that really impresses the fear and the adrenaline on whoever's listening to it.
Yeah.
That becomes part of their experience and their memory. And they may never have the same experience exactly, but they will learn from it in the same way. To the point where we create these fantasy worlds and these monsters and things. And this largely probably comes from the fact that when we were prey animals, or when we were in a lot of danger, before we sort of became what we are now, the movement in the grass could have been the wind, but it could have actually been a predator. And it makes, if we had said, oh, it's just the wind back then, which is kind of the inclination now, if there's something about and people can't explain, they go, oh, it's the wind, or there's natural explanation. Instinct then would have been to move anyway, because you lose nothing if you run away from the wind, but you lose a lot if you don't run away from a predator that you can't see but might be rustling the grass, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think that all feeds into it as well. And these big monsters that we create in our monster movies kind of represent the forces of nature,
mm-hmm.
things that we can't quite harness, and yet in the films you guarantee every single time we will try and it all goes horribly wrong, which is like the basis for all the Jurassic Park films.
Yes, basically.
But just because that guy got eaten by a T-Rex doesn't mean I will. And okay, yeah, they're velociraptors, but so what? I can totally gel with those guys.
Yeah, and we always have, because of on a hormonal and sort of chemical level, you know, we do thrive on adrenaline.
We need a certain amount of it, and from a biological imperative, we actually need a certain amount of stress in order to become stronger.
Yeah,
and fulfill our potential as you know, biological creatures.
Yeah,
too much of it will actually kill us.
Yeah, which is why I think monster movies still appeal, because even though people will say, oh, I'm not really that afraid of them anymore, they still appeal to a very primal part of us on that evolutionary scale, as you were saying. I mean, this is what I believe. And that's why people find them exciting. Well, some people find them exciting.
Well, generally, there's something in there, even if you're not terribly interested, there's something in there that will make you jump. The first Jurassic Park film that came out, no one had ever quite seen the animatronics done like that. It was so convincing. You don't see repeats of a lot of the old dinosaur films anymore. And if you did, you'd laugh your ass off, really.
Yeah.
Because you grew up with Jurassic Park. But Jurassic Park came along in my mid-teens, and it did genuinely make me jump. It wasn't frightening, but it triggered that fight or flight reaction, which I think was obviously what it was meant to do.
Yeah.
It had slightly more impact on some on some of the children of that time, the younger children. I babysat for various different kids back then, and there were two little girls who I was looking after, and their mum and dad had allowed them to watch Jurassic Park. This is a couple of years after it came out, and one girl went to bed no trouble, and the other girl came down a little bit later, and I was like, well, what's the matter? And she was frightened to go to sleep because of dinosaurs. And well, I mean, you don't laugh at kids when they do that. So we went upstairs and we checked under her bed for Velociraptor. And
I could totally get it.
Yeah, I explained that obviously they'd been extinct for hundreds of years and that it was all fantasy, and probably my explanation of the genetics actually put her to sleep in the end, so that was good. But I mean, thinking about it, what was it that made you frightened to go to sleep when you were young? And in my case, it might have been, what did I see? It was vampires. I saw some really old Hammer horrors, and it was kind of like, well, there was must have been one Bela Lugosi performance too many or something. For years, as a very small child, they freaked me the hell out. And what I really needed was somebody to tell me how the makeup and everything was done, how the special effects were done. But instead, what they kept explaining to me, the person I asked, what this person kept saying was how an actual real vampire would feed, and that wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking for, so how do they make this fake thing? But I didn't really have the language to say, I want you to explain how this is fake and how it works so I can sleep at night.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was, I was definitely afraid of velociraptors and T-Rexes. I did think a lot about how I'd survive them. I love that first Jurassic Park film. It was incredible.
Yeah,
it really is an amazing film. And even to this day, it's very, very good, and it's very, very scary. In its places. I mean, God, we used to howl with laughter when the lawyer was eaten off the toilet every time. But like, it definitely had its really scary bits. For me, when I was that age, it was terrifying. And I was definitely afraid of velociraptors, and I was definitely afraid of T-Rexes, even though I thought they were awesome. But I was also, I was frightened of wolves for a short time. I was just really frightened of wolves and werewolves and the idea. And zombies. Zombies really freaked me out. But the thing that really scared me for quite a while was the xenomorph from Alien.
Well, that's actually quite reasonable.
Yeah, because I watched that when I was far too young. I don't know what my dad was thinking. He was there like, oh, yeah, you're 10. Let's just put on Alien.
God, I had to be 13 before my dad would let me watch that. And he sounded me out, pretty much spoilified me for the entire film before I watched it to check I'd be okay.
Oh, yeah, no, dad did not. And I was so scared. I was so scared.
The thing is, the first film, the first Alien film, is actually a monster movie in space, but it's also a thriller, and the two things combined there really do give you a spike of fear.
Yeah.
Which, you know, fear is necessary, as we've said. You have to stress yourself a little bit in order to get better. And there is something to be said for having your nightmares when you're a child, because if you don't deal with that fear and learn how to manage it when you're a child, then
yeah.
you turn into a quite maladjusted adult.
Mm.
But if you go into that first film still has bits in it that will make me jump, even though that I know they're coming. And the second film's more of an action movie.
Yes.
I mean, they weren't going to ever surprise us with the alien.
See, I never really watched the other films.
I suppose I don't want to say they're family friendly, because, you know, it's an alien and acid for blood kind of thing. And it's going to be pretty gory, but they are very much more... They're all a little bit different. I mean, the first one is, as I said, kind of a thriller monster movie. The second one's more of an action film. The third one, when they're in the prison, is a bizarre sort of rumination on good and evil.
Yeah.
The fourth one is a bit sort of more Frankenstein, in the sense of, well, we keep trying to import this alien, let's create one of our own and we'll mix its DNA with human DNA. And it's a very sort of, perhaps we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And then they've kind of rebooted it and gone back to Prometheus, which is interesting, but still follows the same sort of Frankenstein precepts.
Yeah.
And then the most recent one is far more about why you shouldn't frig around with AI and why all forms of life only belong to themselves, even if you created them.
Yeah.
So it's taken an interesting trajectory.
But yeah, I've never been able to. The xenomorphs really freaked me out. And that first film, I think it was the thing which really scares me is just the idea of total powerlessness.
Yeah, like, again,
they are powerless. Even when they shoot it, even when they hurt it, it's weaponized because it's got acidic blood, you know?
Yeah. And they hunt in packs.
Yes.
And, you know, they're pretty much armor covered and very difficult to kill. You can't exactly go toe to toe with them and punch them.
Exactly. And I think that's essentially what the monster movie is about. It's the idea of being totally overwhelmed. You know, facing something which is in no way your equal.
Yeah, definitely. There is an element of letting sleeping dogs lie, though, isn't there? Because with King Kong, it would have been fine if they just left him on his island in the first place, instead of trying to import him to be part of, you know, Coney Island attractions. With the alien, it's a case of, well, we sent people there to become infected so that we could import the alien and then weaponize it to use against other people.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you stopped trying to do these things and control these forces that are outside your ken, probably everything would be okay.
Yeah. And that's, again, we come to Frankenstein.
Yes.
Which is what that is entirely about. It's about the advancements of science, basically. And Frankenstein was a different thing because it wasn't about weaponizing. And that's something, you know, which is based very much on the fears and the current concerns that we have now. But, you know, with Frankenstein, it was all about the fears of what modern medicine is doing and the moral questions of what's right and what isn't. And because there was a very religious component, which isn't as prevalent now. So now that, you know, the question is, it's about weaponry, it's about weaponizing things, and you see that a lot, or it's about sort of making profit out of it rather than, because those are the moral questions that we're faced with today. But the core of the monster movie still remains this idea of interference with things which are beyond us, and then the consequences of doing that.
Yeah, and Jurassic Park is obviously the perfect example of the whole Frankenstein issue.
Yes.
In the sense of they create the dinosaurs, because obviously they're long extinct,
yeah.
By frigging around with genetic material they took from a mosquito that was preserved in amber, and then filling in the gaps with genetic
frog
material
DNA.
Taken frogs, which they kind of didn't... They had this brilliant idea of, we'll make all the dinosaurs female. Which, okay, A, that's really stupid, because in the animal kingdom, the female is nearly always far more vicious than the male, particularly with things like reptiles.
Yeah.
So, A, that was very, very stupid. They also didn't take into consideration that certain species of animals change gender if there's a gender imbalance, or a sex imbalance, rather.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where they went wrong. And then the dinosaurs were then able to breed. Everything got wildly out of control.
And things, yes, escalated.
But I mean, yeah, it is the absolute classic line is Jeff Goldblum saying, we've spent so long looking at how we can do things that we've stopped asking ourselves whether we should.
Yeah.
Which again is classic Frankenstein, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that's probably why Jurassic Park is another one that we sort of come back to a lot and we just keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
And what people fail to understand is some of the Jurassic Park films, they've kind of lost the essence of what it's about because they just think, oh, people just really like dinosaurs. And we do. We do just really like dinosaurs.
We do.
God knows. We're pretty crazy over them. And I'm all for watching Chris Pratt ride around with a bunch of velociraptors. This newest film that they're doing, it appears to be that, yeah, they've taken dinosaur DNA and they've created a new type of creature.
Yeah, which was a bad idea.
I think which was a bad idea. And it's a story we've seen 100 times before, and yet...
We can't look away.
We can't look away.
We have to watch it. I know for a fact that I will watch that film. I may not go to the cinema to see it, but I will watch that film.
Yes.
I never grew out of my dinosaur phase, so there's that. Most kids go through a dinosaur phase. It's like, wow, these things were real once. As I said, I never grew out of that. I love dinosaurs. I love megafauna. And I still find it really fascinating now. And every time they find this new thing, I'm like all over that shit, you know? I'm reading the journals. I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but I'm just so fascinated. But at the same time, I also think, knowing how aggressive lizards naturally are because of the way their brains are formed,
yeah,
and it depends on different types of reptiles. Obviously, lizards is probably a bit unfair. But if you think about caiman and you think about alligators and crocodiles, there's a reason they call the most fundamental primitive part of the human brain the lizard brain. That's the part where all your aggression lives. And
yeah.
If we studied this at university, and the way the skulls are formed show that that part of the brain was extremely dominant and is still very dominant in a lot of reptiles.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's take something like a caiman and create a T-Rex kind of thing, because that'll go well.
Oh, little fun fact for you, though. You know that you often see it, the map of here be dragons.
Yes.
There is such a map in existence, but actually the here be dragons line was in reference to Komodo dragons.
I think I had heard that.
Yeah.
Komodo dragons are fascinating, though. I mean, they're giant monitor lizards, and they are pretty terrifying.
They are really scary, yeah.
Have you seen one in real life? Because they're huge. Humongous.
I might have done, but like they're big, they're scary, they will eat you, and they are... That their bite is, it's not poisonous, it's toxic.
Yeah, it's toxic because they eat carrion. And it's very deliberate, it's like hyenas. They will start eating you as you run away. So they'll bite you, and then they'll slow down and let you wear yourself out. And of course, your bite will fester because of what they eat and the bacteria that live around their teeth.
Yeah.
And obviously blood loss and shock and the fact that there's a really great lizard running after you.
Yeah.
It's not good. It's not a great way to die.
No, it really isn't. But there's this whole... I just remember a story of them going to a sort of Komodo... A bunch of people going to a Komodo island. And for the most part, it was okay. But then... they left one guy on the beach, just sat in his chair, and he just disappeared. And the Komodos ate him. That was that. They just got close and the guy couldn't do anything. And then that's it. He was eaten. So they're pretty scary. You don't want to... Yeah. And again, they go in packs as well.
Yeah. It's the same with... It's not that alligators and crocodiles hunt in packs. They don't generally. But it's the fact that they don't ever really stop growing. Alligators are fascinating. Did you know that their blood contains a natural antibiotic? Because they're most dangerous to each other. And sometimes they lose limbs and things, but they very rarely die of a festering wound.
Yeah.
Because of this stuff in their blood. And as I said, they don't really stop growing, so they can become like 3-4 meters long, which is terrifying. And they are just very aggressive. And you're probably, if you can see one in the water, you're safe from the one you can see in the water. It's the ones you can't see.
Yeah.
The problem.
Now, I've been doing a lot of research into crocodiles at the moment because I am. There's just a crocodile in one of the stories that I'm writing. And they are not only are they very, very aggressive, they are really apex predators because they can survive for weeks without food.
Yeah.
For weeks. They are so patient. They're also very, very smart because they learn very quickly. And there's one thing that sort of continues in the story is that this boy, Azri, has got a pet crocodile. And everyone, you know, everyone's there like, oh, you know, he's this crocodile is domesticated in some ways. Azri's trained it. And Azri's there like, yeah, but you don't understand. One day I'm going to get complacent and I'm going to be with him and I'm going to be a little bit too close to the water. And he's going to grab me and he's going to drag me in and he's going to eat me because he's just waiting. And he's quietly, and Azri's there like, you don't understand. He's quietly conditioning me to trust him. It's not the other way around.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. And I saw this great thing when I was studying it about just a guy who was feeding a crocodile. They were trying to sort of see their reactions. And what would happen is that, yeah, you would touch the crocodile's nose or something like that and sort of throw in food. And every time the crocodile would just go a little bit further back and a little bit further back. And I was like, and what he's trying to do is he's trying to lure me into the water.
Yeah.
Because he realizes that he's giving me something I want because I'm rewarding him. So he knows that I'm going to keep feeding him. So he's trying to lure me into the water. And the moment I'm too close, that's it for me. So they are really scary because they are smart. They are aggressive. They can last for a very, very long time without food. And they are very patient. And we get lots of big crocodile. We get big crocodile movies as well.
Yeah, I want to say Lake Placid, but that's not the crocodile, is it? That's something else.
We also get big snake movies.
Yeah, big snakes.
Big snakes. Snakes are also quite scary.
I really, really like snakes. I have a healthy respect for them, but yeah. I will quite happily handle snakes. Having said that, I do know what I'm doing. I have been taught.
I think the other thing is sharks.
Yeah, sharks are an interesting one because they are aggressive, but we're not their natural food. The reason we get attacked usually is because if we're out on a bodyboard or a surfboard, we look like seals.
Yeah.
So we look like food. And the reason so many more people survive being bitten by sharks, you know, they're not killed by the shark outright. They might die of wounds later. The reason is the shark goes, ooh, nommy food, takes a bite, then spits it out and goes, ugh, that's not what I normally have. That's not seal. That's a disgusting imposter.
Yeah, exactly. But the interesting thing is pointed out that sharks cannot, that sight isn't very good.
No.
The only way they can test things is with their mouths. So they will. They'll just go, ugh, and they'll let go. So they don't really tend to eat people. The scary ones are the rogue sharks, which will get a taste for human flesh and will actively hunt them. And there's just scary stories in Australia about a shark that literally swam, a great white that swam upriver and was sort of hanging around in a sort of a very calm little area where the water was meant to be safe. And it was just a bunch of boys playing in the water and one jumped in and just did not emerge again. And they finally managed to hunt this shark down. And they opened it up and it was just full of people. It'd just been munching on people and hunting them. So we have these occasional horror stories of rogue sharks. But I mean, realistically, actually, sharks are more in danger of us than we are of them. You're more likely, statistically, to be killed by a cow than by a shark. So of course, you know, that does, people say, oh, you know, you're more likely to be killed by a cow than a shark. I'm like, yeah, unless of course you live in Australia and you spend all your time in the sea, then you're probably more likely to be killed by a shark than a cow if you've never seen a cow before. But in general, cows cause more deaths than sharks do yearly. And I mean, to be honest, toddlers shooting their parents in America cause more deaths than sharks do. Falling out of bed causes more deaths. Falling in the shower. Like, it really could go on. We're very dangerous people with ourselves. So, you know, sharks should mostly just be left alone. But it's then we have Megalodon.
Yeah, oh, Megalodon's a great one. I was going to say, it's usually the smaller sharks, like tiger sharks and things, the more stealth predators that wait for something to come by that are slightly more dangerous. But as you say, you get the rogue ones, which is what basically Jaws, the film, is about.
Yeah.
Which is a boy's own adventure story and a monster movie at the same time, and it's a terrifyingly huge great white.
Well, yeah, see, the thing about Jaws is it's also actually a western.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
It falls into the Western category because it follows the tropes, like a dangerous stranger comes to town, and that's the shark, starts causing trouble. and they kind of have to hunt it down and have a face-off, basically, with it. But yeah, so Jaws really sensationalised that kind of monster movie. And I think the reason Jaws was so successful was that it was a monster movie about a creature that does actually exist.
Yes, unlike things like Godzilla, which require a bit of a leap of faith. I mean, you know, sort of 40-foot tall lizard walking on its hind legs and destroying downtown Tokyo.
Yeah. Sometimes with laser beams and
and sometimes it comes back as Mechagodzilla.
Mechagodzilla. yeah, we have to suspend a little bit more disbelief, unlike with, sharks, which we do have, and there are big and scary sharks, and there have been shark attacks. And Megalodon was actually a thing, and there are some people who believe that down in the depths, Megalodon still lives.
See, I wouldn't necessarily throw that out completely, because we thought for a long time that Homo erectus died out about 10,000 years before it actually did, and it was living side by side with Cro-Magnons and very likely interbred with us.
Yeah. So I mean, we keep saying, no, these creatures are extinct, and then finding them in the depths. So, I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that there is a very, very giant whale-eating shark that continues to live. There's also, I mean, the problem is that we just haven't explored the depths of the water, which is why, actually, I think a lot of monsters. We get monsters that come from space.
Yeah.
Because that's unexplored. But recently as well, we've had a lot of under the water monsters coming out. So things like Pacific Rim, they came out from under the sea. Godzilla comes out from under the sea. Because it's just so unexplored, and the ocean just keeps spurting out these surprises that we aren't expecting.
Yeah. Well, you'll like this one then. I mentioned Myra Grant's book Into the Drowning Deep before about the flesh-eating sirens, but they look like mermaids.
Yes.
But this is actually based on a slightly rogue fringe scientific theory whereby during human evolution, a branch of humans split off and actually went back to the sea.
Yeah.
And that's what they hypothesized that these sirens come from, because they're extremely intelligent, they're adaptable predators, they're natural mimics, so they listen to us once and then they mimic our sounds.
Yeah.
Perfectly. And they have a language of signals to each other, quite a complex language of signals, so they communicate as well as we do to each other, and they hunt in packs. This is obviously a horror novel, but it's really plausible. And they're down in the Mariana Trench in the Pacific Ocean, and we have no idea what's down there.
Yeah,
it goes so deep that we genuinely can't go down far enough to really find out everything that's there. So there you go, flesh-eating mermaids. There's a very slim possibility.
I could totally believe it. I could totally believe that there's something vaguely humanoid down there.
There is sort of, there's the entertainment factor with big monster movies as well. I mean, there's something very comforting about contemplating the sort of fear that you'd feel for a predator that was after you from the comfort of your own living room.
Yeah.
You know, that's fear in a manageable dose. And also, it's fascinating as well.
Yeah.
Not everyone, but the people who like the Jurassic Park movies and like dinosaur films aren't just dinosaur enthusiasts. What they like seeing is the usual tropes being hit, which is a case of Someone decides to play God. Someone goes, no, that's a really bad idea. Bunch of people get stranded. Someone runs around and does something stupid they shouldn't do that pisses the dinosaurs off. You see a couple of grisly deaths. It's really harrowing. And, you know, then a couple of people escape at the end, but the dinosaurs are left to themselves and anything could happen. And my sister basically summed up this entire plot for me every single Jurassic Park film. And that is what she looks for. And if it hits those beats, she's a fan of that film. Because she didn't grow up her dinosaur phase either.
It's true. And like, it's not, there's not a bad thing. It's following a very comforting, schedule isn't the right word.
Sort of a journey.
Yeah, it's following a very comforting template which we're familiar with. And it's, as you say, it's quite nice to be able to sort of face these kinds of fears in a position where you are safe. And at the end of that thrill, you can actually sensibly tell yourself, no, this isn't actually a real threat. I don't need to genuinely be afraid. Because this thing obviously doesn't actually exist.
Yeah.
Which is probably actually why films that draw on realistic kind of horror are conceived as being, are scarier. So, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, films and things like that, that draw on horror and monsters which do exist and could plausibly be, you know, targeting you in a very real scenario, can actually really unsettle people, which is why monster movies are kind of in their own, despite, you know, featuring a lot of tropes which would you would usually associate with horror, are on a different level. I can't really watch horror films, but I can watch a monster movie film because there's that separation of reality between the two.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. I know what you mean. And there's something... human monsters are far worse than anything else we can conceive of, I think.
Yeah.
Because what that you're confronting then is not a safely packaged couple of hours of fear or whatever that you can manage. It's the knowledge that you too might have the potential for this within yourself.
Yeah.
Or there might be someone out there who does, and there's something that looks like you that you absolutely cannot reason with. I think that's why films like The Terminator, the original one when it first came out, that was actually genuinely quite scary.
Yeah.
Because it's this thing that will not stop.
Yeah.
And yet can look human.
Yeah. I think that is the idea that you cannot reason with something.
Yeah.
Something that you cannot reason with. Something that is just so strong. So much bigger than you. That's terrifying.
Anyway, there's also the sort of soft monster movie, which sounds a bit silly, really, but it's things like The Land That Time Forgot and
yep.
1 Million Years BC, which has been, there's two versions of that, a 1940s one and a 1960s one with Raquel Welch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hilarious because you have humans living alongside dinosaurs for a start.
Yeah, naturally, isn't that what happened?
Well, according to certain Christian sects, yeah, that's exactly what happened. But they're also really entertaining, and I've kind of got a bit of a soft spot for them, no matter how implausible they are, and no matter the fact that the dinosaurs are utterly ridiculous. And they're not really scary monster films at all, but there's a sort of fascination there. They're sort of alternate history fantasy, almost. And then you have things like, you won't have seen this, it's an ancient film. It's called Baby, The Last Dinosaur.
Okay.
It's about a couple of zoologists who are out in the rainforest and they discover the last living family of Diplodocuses.
Mm-hmm.
And there are obviously evil hunters, poachers out there too. the baby dinosaur gets separated from the two parent dinosaurs. Okay, we already know this isn't how it works in dinosaur herds, probably.
Yep.
And it's a film I enjoyed as a child, and I think if I saw it now, it would be very, very clunky. It's interesting how quiet it used to be, repeated almost every Christmas, and then Jurassic Park came out and it sort of disappeared.
Oh.
And possibly because the animatronic baby Diplodocus was so improbable. And the other thing is, I don't know if you ever saw Dinotopia.
No.
Two brothers and their father are flying, their father's a pilot, in a small private plane, and they hit something a bit like the Bermuda Triangle, really, but a storm blows up out of nowhere. And the two brothers end up crash-landed on an island where dinosaurs have never died out. But, the predatory dinosaurs are still very predatory, but the herbivorous dinosaurs actually work with the indigenous people of the island, so they sort of travel by Brontosaurus and Diplodocus and things like that. And some of the more, raptor-like dinosaurs have become educated and mastered human speech and work in libraries and...
What?
I know. It's absolutely brilliant. And they have some of the early birds and things as well. And it's incredibly improbable and utterly ridiculous, but it's all about living in harmony with your environment. And I suppose it's even a little bit facile, really. But yeah. As a sheer sort of a couple of hours away from life kind of entertainment thing, with a few monsters in that aren't very monstrous, it's great fun. But it's interesting, isn't it, how it's always dinosaurs. Dinosaurs have always really captured the imagination.
Well, I just think from the moment we kind of figured out what these giant bones we were finding belonged to, we couldn't help but be fascinated by these creatures that lived before us. And I also think there's an element of preservation which comes into it as well, because we as humans are now the top of the food chain, really, for the most part. And I guess sort of studying dinosaurs has an element of humility to it, because it basically says big, strong things can die out.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I think we're just really fascinated by how they lived and what happened and what was going on, really.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Unless somebody really does do a Jurassic Park. And to be fair, Jurassic Park should be called Neolithic Park and Cretaceous Park and various other things, because they've totally mixed there. Unless somebody does create a zoological park like that, you're never actually going to see them in real life.
No.
Which is probably a good thing, if the films are anything to go on.
Yeah, the films have quite clearly said that is not a good idea. though, using DNA, it may be possible for us to, not dinosaurs, but to actually bring back some extinct species.
Yeah, well, they're working on a project to bring back woolly mammoths, aren't they?
Yes, and also some other mammals as well.
Using a nucleated elephant ovum.
Yep. So yeah, some other mammals as well, and it's promising research, because there have been some species which have gone extinct within our lifetime, several species that have gone extinct within our lifetime, and it would be a major step towards conservation and preservation if we were able to actually bring those creatures back to life. But the idea that one may be able to bring back dinosaurs is at this time just fantasy, and probably should remain so for as long as possible.
Yeah. Okay, so what's your favourite kind of monster from a monster movie type thing?
Oh, Christ. I honestly don't know. I've never really been that interested by King Kong, or just big gorillas and stuff like that. I always do like the big things with the big teeth. So I like the T-Rex. I say I like them. I'm scared witless of them. But I think probably Megalodon.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Really appeals to me. Appeals for that, because it's big sharks are just so terrifying. And I really should add, I really like sharks. I think they're great. I think they're very graceful. I think they're amazing. I think they should be left alone. But I do like a good... I say I like a good shark movie. I won't actually watch them because I'm terrified. But I like sharks. So probably Megalodon.
I've got a lot of affection for King Kong, but I don't know if that's just because in some ways that was the first monster movie that really can, and I would have been a very small child, sort of about 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah.
Probably even a bit younger than that. So I've got a lot of affection for that. But probably just dinosaurs in general. Because we Jurassic Park, you're right when you say that the first one was something special because it captured the magic of it as well.
Yeah.
Which is what made, that magical sort of almost you've stepped into an oil painting feeling, Land Before Time, at the very beginning, and it's just amazing and breathtaking, which makes all the horror that comes afterwards so much worse.
Yeah. No, it does. That is the actual thing about Jurassic Park, is that right at the beginning, you kind of feel like it is a good idea.
Yeah, it's like
they've got a handle on it. It looks amazing. Like, you'd want to go.
look at the safety. Do you know, I feel so sorry for the guy who created the park, because he keeps going, I spared no expense, and like you can see he's really enthused about it, but you can also tell that he's cut corners in the sense of whether he should go through and do this. I mean, he hasn't cut corners on safety and things, but he's been so enthusiastic he hasn't put enough fail safes in place.
Yeah. No,
so I don't know.
I think that's actually... The other thing was that there's an element of the old monster movies which really did play into the majesty of these creatures as sentient, intelligent beings.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I will still maintain that the actual real monster in Jurassic Park is the guy who's trying to steal the eggs.
Yes. Yeah. He gets everything that's coming to him.
Yeah.
Because if he hadn't, actually, I think Jurassic Park would have probably been okay.
Possibly.
But yeah.
Anyway, that's probably all the monsters we can talk about this week. The man-made ones.
I feel like at some point we should probably bring Hamish Steele onto the show because he knows a lot about kaiju. So
yeah,
he could probably tell us all about kaiju. So at some point we'll probably come back to this this discussion and bring our kaiju expert with us. Now, before we go, it's time for Dissecting Dragons' recommendation of the week, and this week Jules has got one for you. So, Jules?
Yep, I recently, this week, finished reading Circe by Madeline Miller. Madeline Miller wrote The Song of Achilles, which I'm just working my way through now, because after reading Circe I had to go on to that immediately.
Mm.
I hadn't got to it before. It's just absolutely brilliant. I think it's probably even better than Song of Achilles. If you like Greek myths at all, then it's absolutely for you. It's so easy to get into. The prose is absolutely gorgeous. And it gives a voice to a character who turns up in lots of different Greek myths as a side character and gives her a voice of her own. And It really sets it in the place and time. Because, I mean, you know that Circe is obviously the daughter of Helios, the Titan sun god, by Pasiphae, this cunning nymph who he marries.
Yeah.
And he has hundreds of children, including a herd of sacred cattle. Because, you know, if you're a god, why would you just have human children?
Of course.
And it's really interesting. She is literally the least of everything in so many ways. And then she accidentally discovers she's got witchcraft. But she's honest about it, so she gets imprisoned on an island. I'm definitely paraphrasing here, but it's so worth reading. It is an incredible story. And it's so great to see from a side character's viewpoint all these Greek heroes sort of trotting by because she lives for thousands of years. So you hear a little bit about Perseus and you hear about you actually meet Jason and you get to hear what she thinks about him and it's hilarious. hear a bit about Theseus. You get to meet Daedalus and, before he creates the labyrinth, and you get to see the Minotaur being born, and it's like getting a guided tour through all the major Greek myths. It's absolutely amazing. Magnificent book.
Okay, all right. I will put that on my list. I've got to read Song of Achilles first, though. And on that note, guys, be sure to leave us a comment or send us a tweet and tell us what's your favourite monster and what's your favourite monster movie. But for now, we will catch you guys up next week. Bye.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.